You're listening to the Allan Gray Podcast. I am Sipisihle Zwane, a portfolio manager at Allan Gray, and your host for this episode. The past decade has been a challenging one for domestic South African businesses. From slowing economic growth, made worse by COVID lockdowns, infrastructure challenges, and high food inflation in the latter years. However, since the formation of the Government of National Unity and extended periods of uninterrupted power supply, sentiment on the country has shifted, with most of the major retailers such as Spar, ShopRite, and Pick n Pay seeing improved share price performance. Joining me today to discuss the key themes shaping the retail sector are portfolio managers Jiten Pillay and Kamal Govan. They will shed some light on our thinking behind the retail exposure in the funds and key learnings and experiences from 5 decades of investing in the South African market. Kamal, it's your first time on the podcast, and I thought I'd start with you. Your previous life, you were on the other side. You worked in more operational and strategic roles. What led you to come to our side of the market? I mean, to be under the buy side, researching and investing in companies from the more operational side. So what led you to come join us at Allan Gray?
So I studied accounting almost by mistake. And the reason was my entire family are involved in some sort of business. And so being in and around business was a natural thing for me. I really didn't know what to study or what to do. Accounting seemed like an entry into that space. As you rightly say, after doing accounting kind of by mistake and doing articles not because I liked auditing, and then I came to a crossroads, like, what do I want to do now? And management consulting seemed like a cool thing to do, to see different businesses and different topics within each business. Eventually, through that process, narrowed down that investing is actually the perfect blend of understanding businesses strategically, operationally, financially, and then putting money to work behind them. So that's kind of the short history.
Always broad in terms of understanding new companies, looking at different things, I guess, in auditing as well, and consulting as well. And I guess now you get to look at a whole lot of different things, and we'll chat about the retail as well today. I mean, Jiten, you've been on the podcast a few times now. You celebrated, a decade at Allan Gray last year, your first job, and you've kept it. So well done on that.
For now.
What makes you stay, right? You just came out straight out of varsity, one job, one place. You've been here for 10 years. You seem to enjoy it most days. You look reasonably happy, especially when you wear your very bright yellow socks with the cats on them. What made you stay here for the 10 years? What keeps you interested in investing?
To echo the kind of earlier comment, if you're interested in business and learning about different businesses in different sectors, I think there are very few learning grounds that are better than asset management industry, and specifically being an investment analyst. You know, you get to look widely at a variety of companies, look through history to see what's gone right, what's gone wrong, what learnings can you take from that and apply that to companies that exist in your universe today. It's very interesting. Things come to you that you can't always plan for. So, you know, every day is slightly different, and it's challenging. You come to work every day and very likely you'll learn something new. And I think that's what keeps me interested.
On the topic of history, generally when we speak about retail shares, I know we try very hard to avoid anecdotes. It's things that we all like deal with day to day. So it's difficult to not think about your actual interactions with the businesses. So retail in the early 2000s, you know, did incredibly well. So stores were opening all the time. The share prices did very well. So, you know, in my little small town, I remember initially when I'd go to the shop, my mom would give me 20 Rand. I'd buy 2 loaves of bread and milk with that 20 Rand. And to be a local guy who has a shop, a little small shop, if you want to do bigger shopping, you have to travel a little bit further. And then time went by, and then, you know, there was a Pick n Pay where the guy used to be. Then afterwards, there was a Checkers in the same area. Then afterwards, you know, you have a Spar close by. So, you know, all these stores opened up, and somehow they all are quite full most of the time. So maybe just to talk about the early 2000s. I mean, Jiten, you did speak about history a bit and learning from history. Why was it such a good time for retail? What was so different? You know, if you were sitting in 2000, would you have thought that share price performance was coming? Was it obvious at the time, do you think?
With the benefit of hindsight, you know, lots of things are 2020. But I guess what you can say for food retail in particular, you know, if you look globally, it tends to follow a particular model, very much to what you just said. Countries start with the emergence of informal retail. So, you know, you're buying from your local mom and pop shop. You then have a mom and pop shop who is somewhat more entrepreneurial, and maybe they decide to formalize that structure in some way and expand. And so what you see is out of informal retail, you have the emergence of, I guess, what we would call modern retail or modern food retail as we see it today. And then that modern food retail expands space, opening new stores as quickly as they can. After that, these retailers open space as quickly as they can because the aim of the game is scale and volume. Ultimately, what makes a successful retailer is being as large as possible, because the more volumes you can put through your system, the lower prices you can receive from suppliers, and ultimately the lower prices you can charge to customers. And that is a flywheel that reinforces itself, because if you can now all of a sudden have lower prices to customers, that gets you even more volume. So it reinforces itself, and it's a model that you've seen actually play out in many countries around the world. South Africa in the early 2000s was at that early stage of, you know, informal retail into consolidating formal retail. You know, if we had looked at other countries and history, it would have suggested that it should be a very good time to own retail shares. You couple that with very low starting valuations or very low expectations, you know, that's always a good setup for good equity returns. I guess that's the setup. You know, in hindsight, it's easy to say, well, it looked like that would happen. Naturally, things can always play out differently. But looking globally, that has been the experience historically, given where we found ourselves at the time.
With the recent shift in sentiment, I always try to almost reflect on, is there a chance that it's the same thing happening again? And I mean, that's probably quite difficult. In my mind, sentiment is almost like, you know, because investing is probabilistic, you put some weightings on things possibly happening. And then a shift in sentiment is people are putting more weight on the bull case happening. And I guess there's a shift in sentiment in South African retail shares at the moment. If you had to talk about the bull case, Kamal, what is the possible bull case? And then in your mind, what do you think is a chance of that bull case, I guess, for a lot of these retail shares?
The starting point now, relative to Jiten's point about 20 years ago, it's much more difficult to grow now than it was then, right? All our large retailers have thousands of stores. A lot of the white space has been taken up. We have a lot of retail space through the malls and things like that already in place. So just that natural ability to expand is now much more difficult and constrained. So the starting point is harder, I would say. But the bull case is more, well, we've come from this period of low to no economic growth. Sentiment has turned, you know, so if we can turn the kind of top-down picture around from a GDP growth perspective, create employment, more money in people's pockets, and that kind of can filter down, creating a natural environment for some sort of economic growth. And these businesses, you know, they're selling everyday items, and you think they're natural beneficiaries of this sort of stuff. So kind of that's the organic sort of bull case. There are other opportunities for these retailers to grow through small acquisitions and things like that, but, you know, that's a different topic altogether. Just to be a little bit cautious is to say the starting point today is, or the bar is higher now than it was previously.
I think that's a fair comment. If you really want to kind of look blue sky, you could say, well, and the numbers are iffy here, but let's say 20% of food retail in South Africa is still informal or kind of wholesale driven. With that, if you really have a drastic move in terms of populations urbanizing, you know, naturally you would expect more of the volume to shift from informal to formal retail, and then just more money in people's pockets. You know, as discussed, you know, that's a function of economic growth. I think that's more of a longer term story. And in the shorter term, you could say, well, actually, there's some things that are happening right now that should be a temporary tailwind to retail sales. If you think of lower interest rates, lower oil prices, which translate into lower petrol prices, two-pot retirement reform, which is, again, putting more money in the hands of consumers, you know, all of that has the ability to be spent in the economy and particularly on food retail. You know, you put those things together, there can certainly be a bull case to be made.
If you want a real bull case, maybe it's if we can grow our middle class in South Africa, right? If you can get these structural reforms start bearing fruit and economic growth is sustainable, and over time that middle class starts to grow, you'd think that's a real bull case for the retailers in the country.
So I guess if the incomes grow and there'll be way more rotisserie chicken sold at Woolies.
No. that's a difficult feat. They already sell a lot of rotisserie chickens.
To some extent, we can have the growth. And if the pool isn't growing or if the pie isn't growing, we're seeing a lot of this competition, right? These retailers are starting to bash into each other's natural spaces, let's say. Checkers is growing and going after the natural Woolies customer. Everyone's trying to go on the lower end. and these adjacencies that all these companies speak about, you know, the pet food and the baby stuff. And Clicks has a good baby business. Babysitting is probably a good baby business. Everyone's going for each other's lunch. Do you think it's an obvious way to grow, or is it almost an admission that there's nothing else we can do if we want to grow and we have to find different streams of growth? I mean, and it's not obvious that they can do it well, right? So, you know, like a lot of these retailers have struggled, especially with, like, let's say pharmacy, for example. Spa has struggled to actually grow a big pharmacy business because the incumbents are actually so good at doing it. You two, do you have any opinions about the adjacencies?
I agree with the point that it's an admission that growth in the natural business is slower than it was. And so it's almost dabbling in these adjacent businesses to see, you know, which one may work. Mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say that different retailers are experimenting with these different adjacencies, someone like ShopRite doing a few more than some of the others. It's fair for me to also say that they're doing it in a measured way. Mm-hmm. To your point about it's not easy to just compete in a new industry or a new business. Mm-hmm. You know, you do it in a measured way. You take small bets relative to the core business. You see what works. Maybe you fail a little bit, but it's not the end of the world. Mm-hmm. It doesn't put your business at risk. And if it really takes off, it takes off. You know, you get your learnings, you plug it into this massive well-oiled supply chain that some of them have, and you can start to get some benefit of these things. Kind of that's my view.
Adjacencies. If you think about it from a retailer's perspective, you have this core customer. And I think with any business, you're trying to figure out how can you sell more to that same core customer that is hopefully visiting you anyway. Woolworths is a good example. They're rolling out their food service offering. So you would see their Now Nows, their W Cafes within their food stores or next to their food stores. One of the reasons they're doing that is to drive footfall. Ultimately, you know, if you think, and I'm sure we'll touch on it later, but if you think online retail is this big channel that's emerging as a key theme, what you actually need to do into your physical stores is create an experience or a destination. You need to do something that differentiates the experience of coming into store versus buying your groceries on an app. With Woolies, for example, with the food service, you know, it gives you a reason to come to visit the store, to sit down, to linger, to dwell for a bit, have a cup of coffee, and then maybe go back into store and hopefully buy more things. So, you know, ultimately, I think it's just trying to capture a higher share of wallet of that core customer that you're serving.
I think the retailers are also doing it in their core businesses, right? Mm. So we don't always think of it, but a lot of them are trying to serve customers through financial services and all these other products that we don't naturally associate it with buying groceries. Mm. So I think that, you know, they're trying to be very clever about how they think about the customer, the value of the customer, and how best not to monetize them only, but to serve them with all these different things they can do for them.
I always think about how, I mean, competitive the retail market in South Africa is and how incumbents are able to protect their profit pools. Like if you take pharmacy, the regulations of opening a new pharmacy are so difficult that in reality, if you're not one of the two big guys, you really struggle to open new ones. And a similar thing with the liquor businesses, right? So the licensing around it is so difficult that, you know, Tops, by starting earlier than most of the other retailers, has built a proper advantage. And now, you know, Woolies will struggle to open in the same locations, just given the history of those things. I mean, the other thing, I guess, other than adjacencies, is people going after each other's natural customer base and, I guess, tiering of customer groups. Do you think that works the same in South Africa as it does in other parts of the world? So I guess call it the discount model, the LDs and the Lidls that are able to bulk buy very little SKU or stock keeping units, so the number of different items on the shelves. Buy deeply rather than widely and, you know, offer good discounts, more simple stores. Do you think that works in South Africa? It doesn't seem to be something that's grown as big as, you know, like in those sort of markets.
We do have a great example of a successful, what we call a soft discounter, so slightly higher than an Aldi and Lidl, and that's Pick n Pay's Boxer business. Mm. And, you know, maybe the next closest one is ShopRite's Usave business. Mm. And both of those, you could argue, have been highly successful, right? So you gave some characteristics of the business model. You're right. So it's a lower stock keeping unit count, more commoditized type of products. The stores are still great, but, you know, they have things like high private label participation in their stores, and it's a volume game, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, I'm selling the simple stuff to the customer who needs this sort of stuff at a very competitive price. Yeah. And kind of Jiten spoke about that kind of virtuous circle, and, you know, you do a good job, you grow your volumes, your sales, you get better prices from your suppliers, and in turn, you reinvest that back in the model to keep kind of growing over time. So I think we do have it. We definitely don't have those hard discounters like the Aldi and Lidl, where you walk into the supermarket and you actually just see the, you know, the cardboard box on the shelf with a brand you may not be familiar with, but the price is very, very compelling. So there is a nuance here. And I think if you look at that Boxer business model, that was started many years ago, but in the rural areas where it was a natural kind of starting place. And now they're kind of expanding into different parts of the countries and into the city. So almost the reverse of what the traditional retailers have done.
Again, we can look to global experience to say, you know, under what conditions do discounters do well and under what conditions don't they do well. South Africa has some of the characteristics, but you know, not all of them. So if you look globally, you know, what gives a discounter the space to enter a market? It's generally a high margin. And when I say margin, it effectively is, you know, how much of your sales are you converting into profit? So, you know, simplistically, if you sell 100 Rand worth of goods, you know, on average for a ShopRite or a Woolies, only 6 or 7 Rand of that is converted into operating profit.
And you say only, but that's very high relative to a lot of businesses.
It's high, but, you know, if you think of it just as a absolute margin, it's actually very low. To your point, you know, 6 or 7 Rand, if you look to global experience, discounters tend to enter when that number is 5.
Yeah.
So you could argue, well, South African margins have certainly over the last decade improved substantially, and that that maybe creates space for a discounter to come in. On the flip side, you know, we don't have very high wage costs, which you have, for example, in the UK. So that, again, created a cost differential by having a lower employee force, as an example. The other thing that I guess we don't have yet is the willingness of a hard discounter that is likely unlisted and is willing to tolerate losses for an extended period of time in building a substantial business. Again, Aldi and Lidl being private companies, you know, enjoyed that space to do that in Europe.
Yeah.
So, you know, some things in our favor, some things probably not as conducive to discounters, hard discounters entering.
You spoke to Boxer, and I remember like in my hometown where the Boxer location is, it's always like the location is well-placed, you're buying big things, usually month-end shopping. You need to be close to like traveling places, close to usually big commuter areas. I guess with a lot of retail, location used to be like, you know, the main thing. Location was very important. Spas tend to be on your trip back from work and you stop quickly at a spa, or, you know, within the malls, you place the Woolies or the Checkers like towards the end of the malls, easier to access, usually a door from the outside. And they already cared about those sort of things. I mean, if you go outside now, we're probably going to see like 10 low motorbikes with like the Woolies and Checkers branding on it. And that's a huge change to how things used to be before. Do you think almost it takes away that whole benefit of a location, right? People really cared about where you were before, and you set up the store base based on sometimes convenience. And then all of a sudden, everyone's just sitting at home and there's a whole bunch of guys on their bikes coming to you.
I definitely think it changes the dynamics of retail.
Mm.
To your point, you can look at a company like Spa, and you're the expert on this much more than I am. Spa's selling point, to my mind, is being conveniently located. If you now have the ability to order groceries off an app from your home and have it delivered to you fairly quickly, that convenience positioning of a store is less relevant. Because actually, if you're a retailer, you can fulfill from still close by, but you don't have to be kind of very close to the customer. But as long as you have a delivery force that is able to service your customer base, you've achieved convenience. I think what will become more important going forward, though, is I've always thought of online as a new channel. And so you definitely have the customer that will prioritize convenience over product. You can flip that and you can say, well, okay, what about the customer that is prioritizing obtaining, for example, a higher quality product? And this is probably most relevant for the, you know, the Woolies versus Checkers versus Pick and Pay debate, where, you know, Woolies has, I think, pretty objectively a higher quality food product, especially their private label product. To what extent is a customer willing to, well, before they had their own on-demand offering, be willing to sacrifice convenience in order to access a better product? I guess that debate or that trade-off is less now, given that, for example, Woolies also has its own on-demand offering. But I think, you know, in the initial days, when you saw that initial rapid success of Checkers 60-60, it was very much customers saying, well, okay, I'm familiar with the product, big national brands, what I care about is convenience. Mm. And so as long as the product is good enough and I can get it quickly, that's where I'm going to go. I think the next iteration of this is going to be, well, actually, everyone is kind of offering convenience now. Who competes best on product?
Mm.
And I think that that's going to be the next evolution of this.
The other thing we can think about here is actually, what's the natural customer for this convenience offering, right? And in a country like ours, there's room for the convenience at the middle and upper end of the market, but certainly the middle to the bottom end, you know, it's still the traditional things you spoke about, where your store location is very important, not only where it is in a mall, but where it is relative to, for example, a taxi rank or train station, things like that. So I think it's very easy to get caught up. Most of us see these delivery bikes every day, but you know, in the broader context of the entire market, I think location still is very important for large parts of the industry.
So it's interesting with the delivery model, because, I mean, if you speak to most property guys, they're like, the sale is fulfilled within our store. We have like a turnover-based rental. So if the rental is based on the turnover, they want that turnover to be included in their rental. So effectively, you're still paying costs of, as if you're selling it in the mall, plus an extra cost of actually delivering it to the person. Do you almost feel like if we could roll back the time to before COVID and the industry was like, you know, hanging out somewhere, and they were like, okay, guys, let's not do delivery because it's actually is not necessarily that great for economics and it's more of a competitive thing. I almost think if they could, it's almost costing them at the moment, or maybe in some time in the future, we're actually going to have, you know, call it fair prices for the delivery costs and the fulfillment costs.
We talked earlier about the early 2000s. One of the other reasons that retailers did very well is effectively this move to centralized distribution.
Mm.
If you think about what happened pre-2000s, you basically had a food producer who would make something for you, put it into their own truck and deliver directly to a store.
Mm.
What ShopRite did initially was to quite cleverly realize it would be far more efficient to have that supplier deliver to a centralized distribution center. And then that distribution center distributes to stores as and when the product is needed. That was a large part of the margin gains that we talked about earlier, was actually just this move to centralized distribution, which was more efficient. What delivery does, to my mind, is it unwinds that, if you think about it, right? Because if you think, well, actually, you're now disaggregating the economics by having to last mile deliver product to thousands and thousands of customers, that central distribution benefit is being diluted.
Mm.
That being said, you know, you had a more competitive industry. When you have a more competitive industry and maybe overall sales growth is slowing down, you want to compete for the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing was online. And even if it worsened the economics for everyone, you know, if you were first and you could hold on to that, it was probably still in your best interest to do it.
I think if you ask the retailers, they all agree, I think, that the in-store sales and experience is still the most important, right? So this delivery thing happens on the side, and it's very important in today's day and age, as you point out. But that in-store experience, I don't think should be underplayed. You know, we've all been at a store where you're like about to pick the cornflakes up and poof, off it goes, right? Instant delivery guy came and picked it in front of you. And I think there's a limit to that. And hence you see these stores thinking about not only from an economic perspective, but also store experience perspective, moving to dark stores. So basically a store that's exclusively used to fulfill online shopping orders and that sort of delivery model. So there are various considerations in kind of how these guys think about the delivery model these days.
It's also interesting with the delivery model because, you know, depending on who you speak to, it's either very bad or very good for a company. I won't kind of call out specific companies here, but, you know, if you speak to one retailer, they'll say, well, it's extremely profitable because you need to look at the sales as incremental and, you know, to the extent that you wouldn't have had those sales, it's not great. You talk to other retailers and say, well, actually, you need to fully cost this thing. And actually, on a fully costed basis, you know, you've got additional picking costs. You have the person that has to walk through the aisles picking the stuff up that you want. And then you have the extra delivery cost in getting it on the scooter to your house. Again, when your starting point in store is, you know, for 100 Rand, you're making 6 or 7 Rand. You know, if you think about the additional costs that it just requires, just the picking costs alone probably eliminate most of that 6 or 7 Rand, leave aside the logistics costs. So I think depending on how people frame the argument, is also having some bearing on the expansion thereof. Naturally, the retailers that are expanding online the fastest probably have the view that it's incremental and that it's part of an omni-channel experience. So it's a customer that's shopping both in-store and online, not exclusively one or the other.
Yeah.
So I think that it's definitely framing on how quickly these companies roll out these offerings versus those that are a little bit more circumspect on not completely destroying the profit pool of SA retail.
Just to move on to some of the better things that are happening in the market more recently, because we had this chat last year, there was a lot of difficulty, I guess. You know, everyone was talking about the cost of diesel. Everyone was talking about food inflation. I guess it was coming off of it, but there was still some high food inflation. And it seems like most of that is gone. It'll be around 200 days of no load shedding. Do you almost think, you know, the next results would be amazing, right? You've had these costs that are like very big in the base. Interest rates are coming down. Is it coming through? Should we be excited about the next results? what happens next?
To really appreciate it, you rightly point out that load shedding was a big cost and the retailer has no choice but to use diesel to keep the store running. What we're hearing is a lot of those diesel savings are, one, being reinvested into price. So that's good for the consumer, right, and good for their volumes. But secondly, and you know, sadly to say, there is still some diesel cost in the base because we may not have load shedding, but some areas infrastructure is failing and there are still blackouts and things like that. So it's not to say that full impact has been mitigated already. So, you know, that's one way to think about it. The food inflation falling is also a kind of weird one for retailers because low food inflation kind of almost hurts their top line a little bit, right? So, you know, maybe volumes go up slightly, but the price is lower. However, all their costs increase by inflation at least, right? So that kind of can put a bit of a squeeze on profitability if you're not careful. So I think, you know, it may be good for the consumer, you rightly point out, but, you know, you got to think about it carefully. So I don't certainly expect any windfall, but, you know, let's see how that plays out.
Yeah, so the food inflation one is quite interesting because I guess in certain markets, let's say Switzerland, for example, where there's been like very low food inflation and you get some food inflation, but the people are wealthy enough that like food overall is not a big part of their overall spending. So, you know, you can have this high food inflation without impacting volumes very much. And if food inflation is higher than normal inflation, then costs in theory shouldn't go up by as much as the food inflation. So you have this great margin that opens up for a lot of these food retailers. I mean, like Spar had a great time with the higher food inflation in Switzerland as a result. Also when the borders are closed because people run away from shopping in Switzerland and go to the neighboring countries because stuff is so expensive. Maybe just to talk to the companies a bit, when looking at the list of the companies we invested in, there's a lot of, I guess if you had to look at a results presentation, everyone's talking about how we're going to change the business around, self-help, turnaround plan. So Woolworths has their turnaround plan, Pick and Pay has their turnaround plan, Spar has their turnaround plan. And the one company that we're not invested in, ShopRite, doesn't seem to have a turnaround plan and everything seems to be going excellently for them. To start with Woolworths, you know, all these, the three retail shares have gone up quite a bit in the last year. You know, GNU, they've gotten a bit of a share price rally, but Woolworths has lagged the rest a bit. Maybe, Chetan, can you just talk to us a bit about why that's the case? And then maybe while you're there, just let us know where you get your socks from, if you get them from Woolies as well. So we always wanted to find a reason to ask you where you get them from.
I'll start with the last question first. I can claim no credit for buying any of my socks. So that's a starting point. I would be much more boring. Woolies is an interesting one. You know, to your point, post the new government of national unity, you know, the share price is up marginally, but you know, it hasn't certainly performed to the extent of the clothing retailers as an example. There are a few reasons for that. I guess it had been strong prior to that. You know, Woolworths, looking back a year ago, had enjoyed a very kind of strong run in performance. One could argue off a low base. I guess, how are we thinking about it today? You know, Woolies is, call it three business units. You've got South African food, you've got South African fashion, beauty, and home, and then you've got Country Road, which is predominantly in Australia, but they also have a business in South Africa. The food business, which we've already chatted about, is still doing very well. You know, to our minds, when we look at Woolies Food and we benchmark it, not just to South African food businesses, but global food businesses, it is truly one of the best food businesses globally. And this is in terms of the product that it's able to innovate on with its suppliers and sell to customers, in terms of the store formats, in terms of its economics, in terms of the returns they're able to achieve on those stores. So yeah, put that all together, Woolies Food is a great business and is largely doing very well. I think what's weighed on Woolies over the last, call it 10 years, has been its clothing business in South Africa. A few missteps. One of them was, and I'm not a fashionista here, as should be evidenced by my socks, but you know, from what I'm told by others, they got their fashion calls wrong.
Mm.
You know, they kind of lost focus on who their core customer was, and they tried to go more fashionable, more young, and arguably slightly lower quality and fabrication, all of which didn't resonate with its core customer, and naturally the core customer went somewhere else. So what are they trying to do to fix it? Well, first step was to get the fashion right. So reduce the wide assortment of brands, get better product into store, and get it in at a price point that makes sense. You know, the next step is getting, I guess, what they would call availability, which is effectively getting, you know, you fix the product, you fix the pricing, you now need to have a proper forecast demand system that gets the right product at the right price into the right store. And that requires a big investment in systems, which, you know, the company is currently doing. But as a result of that, the clothing business hasn't been firing on all cylinders. To my mind, it's probably been the key determinant of why, you know, Woolies hasn't, to the same extent, benefited in the rally that, for example, other clothing retailers have.
I always think of Country Road, like if corporate South Africa had a uniform, and then Country Road would make that uniform. And it's, you know, most of the time it's done quite well. But I mean, recent times, there's been a bit of a shift. I think they struggled over the last reporting period. Maybe to go back to you, Jitendra, maybe talk to us about what's happening in that Country Road business in recent times. And I guess maybe also the economics. I know it's a bit different, or it does a bit better on margin than most retail businesses.
We can split up Country Road's performance on two segments, really. We can look at it geographically. So we can say Australia versus South Africa, and then we can look at it per brand, because we, you know, we talk about Country Road Group, but actually there are quite a few brands within that. Let's maybe start geographically. Country Road in South Africa is actually doing very well over the last few years. To your point, it occupies this niche premium positioning, and I would argue it's pretty much unchallenged in that niche. To your point, for the corporate wear, the slightly more formal wear, the color palettes that they use, it's a pretty unique position. So in South Africa, they've grown quite strongly over the last few years. Australia has been a bit more of a challenge for them. In Australia, the positioning of Country Road isn't as premium as it is here. So naturally, as you know, it's not just South African consumers that are feeling pinched. You know, as Australian consumers have come under pressure on high interest rates, etc., naturally, clothing retailers in general have struggled, and you know, especially those that are, let's call them mid-premium, naturally you would expect on lower consumer spend for those retailers in that segment to do a bit worse. The other way we can segment Country Road's performance is to look at it by brand. So, you know, Country Road brand, which is the thing people will probably be most familiar with, is actually doing extremely well. And that's, you know, both in Australia and in South Africa. It's actually the other brands like Witchery and Trenery, Mimco, which used to be in South Africa and is no longer here, that are, again, slightly more challenged. I think their strategy is to take the playbook that they introduced into Country Road brand and introduce that into the rest of the other brands that haven't been performing as well as Country Road brand. So we'll see. It's early days in terms of implementing the strategy. But to your point, it's a business that has very high margins, probably can still grow a decent amount. And actually, within the Woolies stable, you know, provide something a little bit different.
Maybe another anecdote, went to the mall recently and walked into the Mr. Price store and it was absolutely full. So I asked the lady, like, you know, why is it always this full? And she's like, you know, this is like the only store in, I guess, the waterfront that's still cheap and everything else is quite expensive. I mean, if you look at the Pick and Pay numbers, the clothing business is also doing incredibly well. Is it almost, you know, like a pricing thing and an economic struggle thing? Or is it just like, you know, incredibly good business? Are they super fashionable as well? You know, are the people at Pick and Pay like super fashionable and they're making like cool clothes? Or is there a big, like, you know, pricing thing and a quality thing as well?
Yeah, so Pick and Pay's clothing business has done incredibly well. You're right. It often gets lost in the bigger Pick and Pay, right? It's a very small component of the business, but profitable. I think they also have a, you know, specific, almost a disciplined niche, right? So they try to do everyday essential items, but they try to be somewhat on trend. It's very low fashion risk relative to a Woolies, for example. it's kind of one of the reasons, you know, we stayed invested in Pick n Pay or were invested in Pick n Pay. You know, we saw some of these green shoots within the stable, Boxer being one, Clothing being the other, relative to some of their challenges in the core supermarket business. And yeah, they're doing incredibly well. The growth prospects for that business are incredibly well laid out. And, you know, things can happen, but the plan is for that business to grow very strongly over the next 5 years, let's say.
I'd be remiss not to mention the ShopRite clothing business, Unique. It's incredible how these, you know, these adjacencies and can grow so quickly, and they've opened a lot of stores. And I mean, you walk into one of those things and it's quite clean. Like, it's well-priced, seems like reasonable quality as well. So maybe something for us to be looking out for there, the ability for these adjacencies to grow. And probably the biggest risk there would probably compete with the Pick n Pay clothing. I think, am I right?
Potentially slightly higher up the ladder. You're right. I mean, the stores are incredible. You know, they have a resemblance to some very nice foreign shops. The quality is good. The availability and the range is very standard and good. And you're right. You know, it's another competitor in a competitive space. So it is something to look out for, even for the likes of, you know, that so-called corporate uniform you kind of laid out earlier.
It's almost like, you know, build it and it'll come. Like, there's so many new stores that open and so many different labels and brands, and just that the competitive intensity in this industry is incredible. Maybe let's go back to the things hiding within portfolios. I mean, we've spoken to Boxer earlier. What do you think makes Boxer's margin, I guess, and performance recently so much better than the core Pick n Pay? What are they doing differently? Is it almost the offering size, maybe a bit more nimble?
So I think Boxer, I think that model, they defined a very clear model for their business, right? So it's this low stock count with a commodity focus and this repeatability, right? You overlay that with just very strong cost management on the back end, and the model works. And they've been very successful in rolling it out. And there's a lot of white space for them across the country in terms of growth. And so, you know, it kind of feeds on itself. And they make about a 5% operating margin for a number of years, right? The IPO or initial public offering. So, the, you know, the first time a company's shares is available to the public market or public investors is coming out apparently by the end of November. And so some of the numbers have now been released. On the flip side, you look at the Pick n Pay business and you know, it's a much more complicated business than people think. So you almost break it up into three parts. So we've spoken about the Boxer part and the clothing part. That's, you know, call it the gems within the stable. Then you've got this big franchise and business within there, or wholesale business. And then you've got the core corporate-owned supermarkets. And I think Pick n Pay's biggest challenge, as widely publicized, is in that core corporate-owned supermarket business. And I think a few of the challenges over the years, one, they really struggled with that central distribution move a number of years ago. Two, you know, their cost base is pretty high relative to their competitors. Three, and maybe this is anecdotal, you know, they perhaps struggled with some of the upkeep of their stores over a number of years and their service levels. And so, you know, in a competitive market, if you're not on top of your game, it doesn't take a lot for competitors to come in and eat your lunch with a better offering, right? And as we've been discussing, you know, you've got the likes of Pick n Pay, ShopRite, Spar, and independents competing with you day in, day out. And so for a business that makes a very thin margin, small things go wrong and it has a very big impact on kind of performance. And once that momentum turns against you, it's very hard to bring it back. And so that's Pick n Pay's challenge right now.
You spoke about the independence. It's almost something that sometimes we underestimate, but these buying groups are actually very well run and they're very nimble and they're able to, like, you know, shift. And they seem to grow sometimes. You know, they take share in areas that maybe some of the retailers don't want to be in as much. We talk about, like, the differences in business models. So sometimes you compare the different shares of the different companies, but in reality, they operate differently and they have very different businesses within them. And I think Spar is one maybe that not everyone understands the business model, where it's not necessarily like an owner of stores, but it's a sort of voluntarily retail model. So it gets the goods to the independent retailers who actually sell to the final customer. And I guess their turnaround recently has been they've struggled to do the right thing for those final retailers. So because of SAP implementation, so that's, you know, the back end of these wholesale businesses, the things that help you figure out how many stuff you have on the floor, who's ordering what. So they've struggled to implement a new system there. And then you struggle to price right and get the things to your voluntary retailers, or, you know, you struggle to get it to the guys. And because they've been doing that, what's happened is that the sales of the retailers has grown faster than the sales that they're reporting. So if you're the guy and you have a Spar in Durban and they're taking too long to bring your stuff, you're going to find someone else to do it for you. And so we call it the loyalty rate has come down quite a bit. And then what that does, that you still have the same cost base on less revenue, and the margin has pretty much halved as a result. So there, what we've been watching very closely is their plans to fix that. And obviously that's working on the IT, get the margin back to 3% where it was in the past. And then you have this other business. So you have a UK-Irish business, a lot of Bidcorp, and Jitin knows quite a bit about Bidcorp, but they have some food services there, and then they have some retail stores as well. That's been an incredible business run by one of the shareholders of the business, and that's grown very well. Switzerland business, it's very tough to operate retail in Switzerland where people run away to across the border to get their sales there. And then they had a Polish business that they basically selling now. Polish retail is a very difficult market, but it does have those things that we spoke about earlier, right? So you have a formalizing market. You know, there's a lot of small players. There's an ability for a business like Spa where if the guys want to stay independent, they just change themselves to a Spa. You still run your own business, and it could grow quite a bit. But you know, the balance sheets couldn't handle that at the moment. So it does feel like our three main retail businesses are really going through, you know, these difficulties, and they have these plans to try and improve.
A consistent theme, actually, in our broader SA equity positioning. You know, to your point, we're looking for these turnaround self-help stories where, don't get me wrong, if the economy is strong and people have more money and are spending it, they will also benefit. But if that's not the case, actually what you'll have is internal levers that these companies can pull to hopefully improve their economics. It's, I guess, why we don't own ShopRite for our clients. You know, it's a fantastic business. They're shooting the lights out in all aspects, but that's pretty priced in on the way I think about it. Share price is making all-time highs on a much higher multiple of earnings versus the other retailers. You know, all else equal, fantastic business. It's just, you know, I think we can find opportunity with some of the other retailers.
The interesting point you alluded to is this international expansion of SA retailers. And that's, I think, fair to say, been a mixed experience, right? If we look across the board, Pick and Pay, for example, back in the day had this business in Australia, which kind of is no longer there. You spoke about Spa's UK and European adventures, mixed performance, Woolies, Australia. I think the less said there, the better. You know, has there been a consistent theme in this international failure? You alluded to just different conditions in different markets. Have SA retailers underestimated that, do you think?
My opinion is, I guess, when the slowdown economically started, everyone felt like they should diversify out of South Africa. And I think it's consistent in a lot of SA Inc. business. So you can take, so Outsurance is one. They're quite mature, big South African business. They sort of started a business in Australia. Oceana bought a business in the US, you know, another business that I look at. So when things slowed down, everyone thought we need to diversify outside of South Africa. A lot of people tried, you know, rest of Africa, which is not easy to operate in. And then South Africans tend to like Australia. So for some reason, there's a lot of Australian businesses as well. So possibly the decision making was the thing that we call following the institutional imperative. And it's just the thing that you did because you're worried about the country. And I think to some extent, sometimes you should probably leave that to the fund managers to decide on their diversification as well, rather than doing it yourself as a business. And it is challenging. There's not necessarily a right to win if you go to a different market. There's like, what do you do better than the people who have already been there for a very long time? And you have the South African management team that operates in a market that they might not necessarily understand the nuances of as well. And then you just like divert your attention from South Africa to there. And then sometimes the financing of those businesses has put them in tricky positions as well. And yeah, it's a very brave thing to do. But I guess they've also learned, right? So now when they try adjacencies or they try to grow outside of the country, it's more measured, slower, not betting the company. Take your time. If it doesn't work, it's okay to exit it. I guess the smarter management teams have taken that approach.
When you operate well in your home country, I think there's a natural tendency to think you can take that expertise and do it somewhere else. History, again, has probably shown us that's less true. Again, not any slight on the management teams, but it's just very difficult to compete. You know, you've seen it the other way with the international entrants trying to come to South Africa, and they've struggled. It's very difficult, I think, to assume that because you're very successful in one market, you can take those learnings 100%, lift them up, and transplant them into another market. Sure, sometimes it works and sometimes it's great, but you know, the base rate for this will be that it's actually very difficult, particularly in retail, where, you know, as we talked about at the start, it's a game of scale. And actually, as a new entrant, trying to compete with a scale player, it's very, very difficult.
I think you mentioned it earlier with the LDs and the Lidls. Like, you almost have to be unlisted with lots of capital and very patient to pull this thing out over very long term. And I guess most businesses don't have that sort of luxury to be able to take this super long term view where you're willing to stomach a lot of losses.
I think the one thing with LD and Lidl is they've done the same thing in all their markets, right? So that hard discount model, that's been a consistent thing they've done. Obviously, experts at it throughout the world. And so, for example, in the UK, they quickly took almost, you know, more than 10% market share.
Yeah.
And so I think maybe that's the one learning from an LD and a Lidl. Well, if you do something unique and really well, maybe that's the key to expand.
I mean, if you had to look at their financials, whenever you can see some of it, like, I think if they were listed, some shareholders wouldn't be happy all the time as well. So they're willing to stomach, you know, low margins or sometimes losses.
You can bring that back to the South African space. You talked earlier about informal retailers being a bit more nimble. You know, if you're a formalized retailer in South Africa, you compete formally. So, you know, you are obligated to pay all of your rates and taxes, all of your VAT, certain business practices that you have to adhere to. You know, in the informal space, those formal requirements are no longer there. You're able to kind of compete on far more levers than you would in the formal space. And actually, the formal retailers, you know, at the end of the day, still have to compete with the informal channel. At the end of the day, if you're a customer, you care about, you know, if I'm buying product X, I want to get the lowest price for product X. And, you know, that's, I think, what most people would be concerned about. You have to compete with this channel that is far more nimble than you are. Yes, they may not have your scale, but to your point, they within their informal channel, they're trying to formalize by forming these buying groups, effectively talking to each other to see, you know, how can we also benefit from group buying and better prices.
If we're to repeat this podcast 10 years from now, let's say we're reflecting on what we got wrong, what do you think are some of the things we should be careful of? What are the major risks that we could get wrong with these, you know, these very self-help type businesses?
To my mind, I think it's a fairly technical term, but I'll unpack it a bit. For me, it's operating leverage. And what I mean by operating leverage, these retail businesses are these big behemoths with lots of fixed costs, you know, costs that don't necessarily change depending on the level of sales. And that works both ways, because if sales growth is very healthy and very robust, you know, all of those incremental sales falls directly to your profit. It also works the other way, because your costs are naturally compounding by inflation. If sales growth is, for example, not growing by inflation, then you have what we would call negative leverage, which is saying if you have a slowdown in sales, it has a much bigger impact on your profitability. I think the thing perhaps I've certainly underestimated over time is the impact of this operating leverage, both on the upside and the downside. So, you know, put differently, if things are going to go well, they're probably going to go much better than we anticipate. Conversely, if things are, you know, if South Africa stays in a muted growth environment, consumers remain under pressure, and sales growth is, as a consequence, muted, I actually think it's going to the downside, have a much bigger impact on the retailers than we're probably thinking about today. So, you know, to my mind, I think just given the nature of these business models, the outcomes at extremes, I think, are higher than we would probably think about today.
The one thing I look out for is kind of complacency, right? So if you think about retail, or the retail we talk about anyway, it has changed over time, but it hasn't like fundamentally shifted. We still go to the stores. We're still doing the bulk of our shopping there. And over time, yes, we've got some of this online stuff coming on and becoming a trend. But, you know, the core principles of retail are still in place. And I think to the extent that these retailers forget that or lose that, like, and some of them have over the last 20 years, I think that's a big red flag. You know, you still got to invest in your stores and make sure they're up to date and in good condition for your customer. You got to prioritize the customer. You got to be efficient on the back end so you actually benefit from this scale and your product availability, pricing, all the just the fundamentals of retail have to be in place. And I think it's easy to lose track of that with some of these potential adjacencies that, you know, may distract them. For me, you know, those that stray too far from their core and it becomes an issue, I think we could see some issues there like we have, and it will continue to happen.
I find it quite interesting, the whole complacency thing, because, I mean, we are investing in companies with self-help stories. So maybe for me, the thing is to always watch if they're actually doing what they say they're going to do, and if it's working. So I guess if you had to sit here 6-7 years ago, ShopRite was the one struggling. They had, you know, lots of wastage. Employees were very unhappy. There were strikes often. Their sort of SAP or their back end system implementation was a bit of a struggle. They had working capital issues as well. And they just did the right things. They spent, now they spend more capital than, you know, close to other market caps of the same listed businesses, because they understand that you have to spend on the businesses. So for me, the one thing that I'll be watching closely in the next, you know, few years is the businesses say they're going to do X, Y, Z. Are they doing X, Y, Z? And if not, why? Just to make sure that the actual plans are going as expected. And if they change, then they must be well thought out and expected, because it is very difficult to do a turnaround in a slow economic growth. It makes it so much more difficult. And I guess it's the operating leverage you spoke to, Jithen. So that brings us to the end of episode 22. Thank you, Kamal and Jithen, for joining me. And thank you for listening. In this conversation, we discussed South Africa's increasingly competitive retail environment, the companies operating in it, and the plan set to improve profitability after what has been a challenging few years. Despite the improving sentiment around South Africa, the businesses continue to operate in an increasingly competitive and challenging market. As long-term research-based investors, we have chosen to invest in businesses that we believe can outperform the economy with tangible long-term plans to tackle recent challenges. If you'd like to get in touch, please send an email to info@allengray.co.za. You can subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcasting platform to be notified of new episodes. Lastly, Allen Gray is an authorized FSP. To view our terms and conditions, please visit allengray.co.za. Until next time, I'm Sipesihle Zwane. This podcast was produced by Volume Podcasts.
Imagine if you could save time like you save money. A second here, a minute there. Type a little faster, walk a little faster. Or you could stop scrolling on the internet. Just think of all the hours you'll save. Now what if you could take all that time and invest it? Watch it grow. Until eventually, one day, you'd have so much time that you wouldn't know what to do with it all. But unfortunately, time doesn't work like that. It can't be stored or banked. And unlike money, you can't make it back. That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time to do whatever you want to do, even if it is scrolling on the internet. Allen Gray, long-term investing. Allen Gray is an authorized FSP.